Hello. In my last lecture, I talked about events beyond the floodplain of the Tigris and Euphrates in Mesopotamia. I talked about the other inhabitants of this part of the Near East, inhabitants who were tremendously important economically and politically to the development of states and civilizations in Mesopotamia and more broadly in the Old World, but who often are not accorded sufficient importance in archaeological texts. And by this, I mean the pastoralist populations, the herding peoples who lived on the boundaries of the cities, the city-states, and sometimes invaded them and took them over. I want to move back now, back to the cities, and speak about a history-making invention, the invention of writing. Truly, of course, a history-making invention. Writing appeared simultaneously, more or less, in Mesopotamia and the Nile Valley just about 5,000 years ago. This is a topic, the development of writing, is a topic near and dear to my own heart, given how much reading I did as a child and how much I still do today. Writing would make possible forms of expression and new kinds of economic, social, cultural, political, ideological systems that would be unimaginable without this vast extension of the human voice and human thought. It would allow the dissemination of human utterances over distances of time and space that would be impossible to span otherwise. It's not for nothing that archaeologists make a fundamental distinction. When we think about the human past, we make a distinction between history, on the one hand, and prehistory, that period that existed before history, that existed before writing. As I've already said, writing provides archaeologists and other researchers with unparalleled access to the thoughts of some people at some times in the past. Its limitations, of course, are in those words, some. Some people, rich people, literate people, powerful people, important people. And sometimes, over the last 5,000 years, over that tiny fraction of the entire period that humans have occupied this earth. Writing also gives rise to a lot of problems for archaeologists because of the differences between what historical documentation is concerned with, usually things of some significance or perceived to be of some significance by the people who are actually doing the writing. One writes things down in a sense because they're important. And those things that archaeology is concerned with and that archaeologists are concerned with, usually the most humble products of human activity. Archaeologists study garbage, and we're proud of it. So there's the potential for tension, the potential for disjunctures between historical data and archaeological data. Although, what I have to note as well, I have to warn people about this, but at the same time, I will note that once archaeologists and historians are conscious of these issues, that consciousness allows us to use both the texts and the archaeological data much more productively. The two can inform one another in ways that are extraordinarily useful and interesting. There's obviously a great deal of interest among researchers in the origins of Mesopotamian writing systems. That is, how did they begin? What are the circumstances in which people in Mesopotamia invented this extraordinary means of communication. We have the same interest with Egyptian writing, which, as I said, is developing more or less simultaneously in the Nile Valley, but we have more data on the Mesopotamian case because of the form of the writing, as we'll see in a few minutes. The question is then, how did that writing originate? What are the circumstances in which writing began to be used in Mesopotamia? Some archaeologists, most notably Denise Schmidt-Besserat, believe that Mesopotamian writing developed over a long period from earlier record-keeping systems. Other archaeologists believe that Mesopotamian writing, a particular form of writing that we call cuneiform, developed very quickly over the period between about 3300 and 3000 BC, more or less as an invention ex nihilo, without any earlier precursors in the late Uruk period. So let's take a look at these two possibilities. And now we're going to go far back in time again, before 5000 BC. As we have seen, small clay tokens appear in Hassunan sites in northern Mesopotamia. And actually, we have some limited evidence of tokens of these sorts appearing on sites in the Near East as far back as 8000 BC. They're a common feature of later farming societies in these areas, and they don't look very impressive, as you can see. They're fairly small and formless, but they seem to have been used in an inventory system. That is, these tokens were literally tokens, probably of some kind of agricultural or craft products. So we have this prehistory of these tokens through time. By the middle of the Uruk period, about 3500 BC, a little bit before, these tokens were themselves being stored within hollow clay spheres or balls called bullae. So you can see that one would take the tokens and then englobe them in this small clay ball, which served to do two things. It served to first conceal the contents, the specific tokens, from outside examination, and second, when it had dried, to prevent covert tampering with the contents. You couldn't get back into this without breaking it. These bullae, then, were increasingly during the Uruk period as well. They were marked with seal impressions. That is, people were taking stone seals and marking them with a variety of different symbols on the outside. And this provided evidence of ownership and or involvement in economic transactions, those economic transactions that were inventoried inside the bullae. So one would have both a secure inventory, the tokens inside, plus ownership designated by the stamp seals on the outside, on the clay, on the bullae. Slightly later in Uruk times, clay tablets begin to appear on Uruk sites. And these clay tablets bear imprints resembling both the tokens and the seals. Now, this seems to have been the results of actually, so this is a clay tablet, and then the tokens and the seals are actually pressed into the clay physically. And they seem to be acting almost as a supplement to the bullae. Because when you think about it, these would allow inventories to be checked more easily without destroying the object of record within. Now, you have to think about this. These bullae with tokens inside them are secure, but they're inconvenient, of course. And the reason that they're inconvenient, you can't check on the contents of the bullae without breaking them. They're a sort of a one-time mark of ownership. If you need to verify ownership, The only way to do it is by breaking the bullae. So these clay tablets would act as a supplement to that by acting essentially as a public record of both the inventories involved in this economic transaction. And when I say inventories, this could be measures of grain, it could be cattle, it could be bolts of cloth, it could be specific weights of copper ore, all sorts of possibilities. So it allows a verification of both the inventory and the membership, the participation. It allows an indication of the participants in the particular economic relationship involved. In the late Uruk period, now, so we see this developing through time. In the late Uruk period, at around 3300 BC, tablets appear. So we've got the development of these clay tablets. Tablets appear inscribed with signs in a script that's designated as proto-cuneiform. Now, these signs are largely pictographic. That is, they represent actual objects. They're depictions of actual objects. But they were made with a wooden stylus. They were not made by impressing those actual objects themselves on the clay. They were made as a depiction with a wooden stylus pressing into the clay. This process of abstraction was probably a vital conceptual leap in the development of writing systems. The idea that one could depict, portray objects without actually having to have them directly to hand. One didn't need to have the object there. One could generate an image of the object in a sense that was entirely familiar, of course, to anybody involved in any sort of artistic endeavor, and certainly by Uruk time, humans, gods, animals, all sorts of objects in the real world were being portrayed, depicted in exactly this way. So now we see that portrayal, the abstraction, extended, if you like, to a new sphere. Besides this proto-cuneiform, then, a related script, proto-Elamite, appears slightly later, just after 3300 BC, in southwestern Iran. Some signs in proto-Elamite seem to have been borrowed from proto-cuneiform. So we should probably think of these two scripts as parallel innovations originating in a common cultural milieu. And I have talked about Mesopotamian civilization as a regional tradition, incorporating a variety of different states, political organizations, communities. So this common appearance of proto-cuneiform and proto-Elamite is likely to have been another expression of this developing Mesopotamian civilization. So, what do we have at this point? We have a situation where, first, there's widespread use of tokens, bullae, and seals, and tablets in and around Mesopotamia during Uruk times, in the 4th millennium BC, and particularly in the late 4th millennium BC. We also have communities where some people, merchants, estate managers, priests, perhaps all, and other groups, are engaging in complex commercial and other kinds of transactions where they really need to be able to keep records and communicate in an agreed upon way. So we get the appearance of these related scripts as a further development, an increasingly sophisticated version of older accounting systems. However, proto-cuneiform and proto-Elamite tablets do not record language per se. They're not written texts. They're still primarily inventories. combinations of pictograms, signs designating different classes of items, or sometimes designating activities like the dispensation of rations in bevel rim bowls, and numerical symbols designating quantities. So their inventories, they depict particular items or classes of items or activities, and then some numerical symbol attached to that to give a quantity of cattle in an inventory, for example. And you will remember those bevel rim bowls. I mention those quite deliberately from my talk on the Uruk period. They remain a very important component in economies and redistribution systems throughout the Uruk period and through the early dynastic period as well. So the combination of standardized measures with, for example, bevel rim bowls and accounting systems at the end of the Uruk period, that starts to look like a bureaucracy. The processes by which proto-cuneiform became a real writing system seem to date to around 3000 BC. That is the beginning of the early dynastic period in Mesopotamia. This may be associated with the increased demands for different kinds of record keeping and communication in and between the larger and more complex city-states of the early dynastic period, their bureaucracies and their economic systems. This transformation of proto-cuneiform involved, first, the transformation of signs from referring to particular things in an inventoried hierarchy to referring to more abstract ideas or increasingly sounds corresponding to meanings in a spoken language. We can see when this happens, we get a great increase in the flexibility of the writing system. We can start to incorporate more abstract concepts, as well as more easily developing the writing system for new sounds. This is often done in part through the use of homophones, words that sound the same. Let me give you an example. If I want to say son, that is, I am the son of my father. If I want to depict that abstract idea of son in a writing system, it's a little difficult to do. How do you depict you're the son of someone? Well, what you might do is use the term for son, the star at the center of the solar system, plus some kind of modifier, and you would know that son and sun, they sounded the same, and you would have a sort of a reminder, a relationship between the two. This is not the Sumerian example, obviously. Sun and sun are not homophones in Sumerian, but it illustrates the principle. And there also needs to be some degree of restriction in and standardization of signs. That's the other element that goes along with the development of a true writing system. This is necessary as signs less directly depicted concrete things and as they began to be used in more domains of communication. And here, for example, we see the development of a particular cuneiform character, that for head, from a fairly realistic portrayal of a human head at approximately 3000 BC to progressively, first around 2800 BC, it still looks more or less like a head. 2600 BC, it's getting significantly more abstracted. And then a progressive abstraction through time to approximately 1000 BC, when it looks, it would not be recognizable as a head if you didn't know that that's what the sign meant. The question now, of course, is which of the models of development of this writing system best fits the data? Schmant Besserat's idea that it developed gradually out of the much more ancient token, bulle, tablet, seal recording system? Or the hypothesis of other archaeologists that proto-cuneiform was a unique invention, that it appeared at around 3300 BC with no real precursor? This issue is still debated, but personally, I find it hard to believe that the quite complex recording systems of the Uruk period, with their impressions of sophisticated seals and tokens on clay tablets, did not play some role in the appearance of proto-cuneiform at about 3300 BC. By the mid-third millennium BC, by approximately 2500 BC then, the script had become considerably standardized, with, for example, a consistent direction of writings and the continuing evolution of the signs. It's after this that we see the steady development in the use of writing that we know from our own world today. One important thing to remember here is the importance of the form of writing, the actual material used in the Mesopotamian writing system. Because this has a great deal to do with not only the accumulation of our knowledge of cuneiform, but also to a great extent the way we think about Mesopotamian civilization in general. Over the long term, cuneiform develops for use on a clay medium. Thus, instead of using a pen to create the signs in cuneiform, one used a stylus that could be pressed into the clay in different combinations of impressions and at different angles. Now, the significant thing here, what's extraordinarily important archaeologically, is that clay is a comparatively resilient medium for receiving such scripts, such texts, especially when we compare it to, for example, paper. It has a relatively high durability. This is especially the case, particularly the case, if it's dried out, and above all, if it's baked. Clay tablets with Mesopotamian writing then turn to a form of crude ceramic, and they can last for thousands of years. This helps explain why archaeologists know relatively a lot about the development of cuneiform in Mesopotamia in comparison to, for example, Egyptian hieroglyphics. Much of the day-to-day writing of classical Egypt was probably done on materials like papyrus, for example, that were significantly less durable, much less durable than these clay tablets. This also probably affects, as I said, I've talked about the development of Mesopotamian civilization, and one of the things I've emphasized, because it was important and because this is the way archaeologists think about it, I've emphasized the role of economic relationships, economic dynamism, the expansion of trading networks in Mesopotamia. Well, one of the reasons we know so much about this is because we have the accounts. We have the accounts. We have the day-to-day record keeping from a variety of sites in Mesopotamia in ways that really don't exist for many other areas of the ancient world. And not just accounts. Last time I talked about the kingdom of Mari and the information that we derived from the site of Mari about pastoralism in northern Mesopotamia. What we have at northern Mesopotamia, at this site of Mari, on the Euphrates River, is a tremendous find of approximately 25,000 cuneiform tablets found there in the 1930s. They were the diplomatic archives of the Kingdom of Mari in a storehouse. They were preserved because, interestingly enough, Mari was attacked and burned down by Hammurabi of Babylon in about 1760 BC. The storehouse was burned down, collapsed down onto the ground. Any other kind of written material, at least as used for everyday purposes, paper, papyrus, parchment, would have probably been destroyed almost certainly being destroyed, or at very least badly damaged in a fire of that kind. But with clay tablets, it essentially turned them into brick, and it helped preserve many of them. It didn't actually help very much having the building fall in on top of the archives, of course, and piecing this vast body of cuneiform together has been the work of decades. But we've got it. And that's the wonderful thing. This also testifies to the diversity of uses to which writing was being put by the end of the third millennium BC, the Mari example. The beginning of the millennium, we have accounts. But by the end of the third millennium BC, we have not merely accounts and treaties, but we have poems and hymns. We have astronomical and medical texts. We have exchanges of letters, at least between members of the nobility and the elites. We have bureaucratic memoranda. I'm still not sure whether that's an advance or not. We have love letters, and think of the embarrassment of having that read 4,000 years later. And on and on and on. Again, with this advance, with the diversification of writing, as people began to realize what you could use this for, the world becomes more modern in a way we recognize. The Mari archives were written in Akkadian. It's a Semitic language associated with the city of the same name, Akkad. While the earliest cuneiform was, in fact, in Sumerian. And as I noted earlier, Sumerian is a linguistic isolate. We know of no languages related to Sumerian, at least existing today. We have to remember that Mesopotamian civilization of that period, of the third millennium BC, and afterwards as well, and before that too, was multi-ethnic and multilingual. And the development of cuneiform reflected that. Indeed, we can see this complexity at least as far back as the parallel developments of Proto-Cuneiform and Proto-Elamite in the late 4th millennium BC during the Uruk period. Elamite is actually another linguistic isolate, as far as we know, like Sumerian, unrelated to Sumerian, unrelated as well to Semitic languages. So we have this tremendous variety of language systems in use in Mesopotamia during this period. Cuneiform was adapted to the needs of a whole variety, a diversity of different languages, including eventually Sumerian, Elamite, Akkadian, Hittite, Luwian, and others. This image that I'm showing you at this point is actually in Elamite cuneiform. The first image I showed you for this talk was in Akkadian. Not that either you or I could probably tell the difference. During the early dynastic period, the use of cuneiform spread far beyond its point of origin in southern Mesopotamia and adjoining Iran, and ultimately inspired the great variety of writing systems that we use today and that we know were used in the past. It made our modern civilization possible in a very real way. It makes possible what I'm doing right now with the resources of vast libraries of archaeological information that are available to me, and it allows me to transmit that information to you. As this was happening in Mesopotamia, parallel events were taking place in an area of the world that we're going to visit next, the Nile Valley in what's now Egypt. One of the great questions in archaeology is whether Mesopotamian and Egyptian civilizations influenced one another during their precocious development, and if so, how did that happen? We'll begin to look at this next time. Thank you.